Hello, and welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, money, the root of all evil?
Well, Ken, to discuss that, we would have to be clear about money and evil and roots. That's a tall order. I'll make you a deal. Let's just stick to money. Let's try to get clear about money. You tell me, what is it and how come I don't have any?
Well, about you not having, I don't know why you don't have any. I know how well paid you are. But look, here's one way to answer your question. Here's a 20 and three runs, ones right from my wallet now. That's money, dude. Answer your question?
No, but it does remind me of a story I heard a long time ago from an economist friend at UCLA. Someone called the economics department, he told me, and this person said he'd made a discovery that he thought was worthy of a Nobel Prize. He wanted to know where to apply. Well, what's your discovery, they said. It's just paper, he said. He was holding it in his hands and rubbing it back and forth, just like you were. It's just paper. It's not worth anything. Now, he had made a great discovery, Ken, but probably he was not the first. Money is just paper. You can't eat it. You can't smoke it, as far as I know. You can't even write on it very easily, but it doesn't follow that it's not worth anything. So you tell me, why are those bits of paper you showed me worth anything?
Well, I think what impressed the fellow in the story, in your story, was that dollar bills, even $20 bills or $100 bills, have no intrinsic worth. Some things we want to eat, like grain, or adorn ourselves with, like gold, or kill other people with, like swords, those things have a kind of direct value. But the value of money is that we can use it to get those other things. Money has what you might call instrumental or functional value. We can use it to get other things. So given that it doesn't have intrinsic value, the value that it does have is pretty important, though.
Now, here's a jingle from Wikipedia about the functions of money. Money is a matter of functions for a medium, a measure, a standard, a store. Now, can you explain that to me, Ken?
Yeah. Well, money's a medium because we use it to get goods and services rather than, say, barter for them. It's a measure because it provides units, a way of counting and measuring things in terms of it.
Well, could you have a medium that wasn't a measure?
Well, suppose you use diamonds as money. I mean, no two diamonds are exactly alike. So if I paid you two diamonds, you'd never know how much you were getting unless you had some other unit to keep track of the relative worth of the various diamonds. That's why precious metals like gold and silver that can be melted and made into standard size units, they're better as money.
So, or in the case of our government, zinc or something like that. But okay, that takes care of medium and measure. How about standard and store?
Well, money is a standard because it's used to say what counts for settling a debt. And that only works because the money I pay you back with has the same value as the money I borrowed from you in the first place. That's the idea of money as a store, a way of storing up value, which actually gets into something pretty controversial.
What's that?
Well, for a long time, the idea was that paper money, like we have today, functioned as a store because the government that issued the money promised to exchange on demand a certain amount of gold or silver or some other commodity of more intrinsic value. So the value of paper money was, as they said, good as gold, or at least it was as good as gold times the probability of the government keeping its word.
Well, I actually remember dollars that said they were silver certificates backed by silver. And I remember my grandfather showing me a gold certificate that he'd held on to even after it became illegal to do so in the 30s. But those dollars and that $20 bill you just showed me don't say anything about gold and silver. They say, this note is legal tender for all debts public and private. It seems somewhat paradoxical.
Paradoxical? How?
Well, it seems that what makes money useful for the first three functions, medium, measure, and standard, is really the fourth, that it's connected, at least by some government's promise, to something of more intrinsic value. But on your dollars, where there should be such a promise, there's instead a statement, really an implied threat. Accept this in payment of goods or services, or else the U.S. government will be really mad at you. Maybe our would-be Nobel Prize winner is right. It is just paper, and it is really worthless, except for a government-enforced shared illusion that it's not.
Well, maybe that government-enforced shared illusion does something. It makes a new reality. You know, so it is a little paradoxical. But luckily, we have a little help getting through this morass about money. Alex Gould from Stanford University will join us shortly.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Polly Stryker, talked to someone who spent time in a society that operates without money. She files this report.
In a world ruled by money, it's hard to imagine economies that work without it. San Francisco State University anthropologist Mariana Ferreira has lived and worked in the Amazon with several groups of Indians, the Kayabi, the Suya, and the Shavanti, who rely on a gift economy.
I had no idea that in order to be called a generous person, that I was supposed to give everything I had away.
Knowing she was going to teach in a remote location, Mariana went to the Xingu Indian Reservation in central Brazil with pots and pans and tins of powdered milk.
During the first week, all of my food completely disappeared, which put me in a state of anxiety because I wasn't very familiar with the food that was eaten in that place too. But very soon I learned that obviously they took all my food away, but I was given much more in return and everybody took care of me.
A gift economy is the antithesis of capitalism, where the person with the most toys wins. It's all about networks of giving and receiving. No bartering is involved.
You invite people on purpose so that they will come to your house or to your village or wherever it is, and you will give them something. And by putting them in a situation where they can't say no, which we actually do a lot in order to avoid other kinds of obligations, you actually establish a form of a contract where they will have to invite you back to wherever they live, and so therefore triggering a circle of very tight social bonds and social relations.
There was an idea that indigenous peoples couldn't understand Western mathematics. Mariana found that they wanted to learn numbers so they wouldn't be cheated out of land or goods anymore by outsiders. She quickly realized they weren't ignorant of plus and minus. They just saw things reciprocally.
I caught 10 fish and I gave 3 to my brother. How many do I have now? And that in school, when you would say give away, sometimes they would use a plus because they would say my brother or my nephew or my uncle will pay me back twice as much because the value of the gift is increased once the prestation is offered.
It turns out that their social philosophy was reflected in their concept of numbers.
Numbers stand for social relations. Whereas we're used to thinking of a unit as one, in the Shavanti people of central Brazil, they think of the unit as two, necessarily a pair.
One was not considered a whole, but rather a half of a pair. Even though they had numerals, the people Mariana worked with didn't keep track of exact numbers of who accumulated what, like us with our bank accounts. So how did this gift economy work in practice?
Sometimes I would see, for example, a canoe loaded with fish coming in, and the person who had actually gone fishing being left with just a few fish and having distributed everything else. Well, guess what? Next time a fish load comes into the village, or somebody goes out hunting or brings a lot of mangoes or whatever it is, that person who is so generous is going to have perhaps first pick.
No Rockefellers or Kennedys here. It turns out the people with the most status had the least stuff.
The status that comes with being the most generous of all, which is what the headman or the leader needs to be, it is usually the poorest and the most, let's say, inconspicuous house that the leader inhabits.
Some of the native peoples do use money for specific goods like fish hooks and soap in towns that border the reservations. And what do they do with the currency that passes through their hands? They treat it like any other fish or fruit they have. They share it. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Polly Stryker.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today we're joined by Alex Gould from the Stanford University School of Business. Alex, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Alex, what attracted you originally to this dismal science of economics?
Well, luckily I had a great teacher, or it would have been truly dismal. I took Economics 1 at the University of Pennsylvania, where I had been going as an undergrad, and the teacher that I had was stunning, amazing, scintillating, and I wanted to work for her, and I needed a job the next semester, and I beat another guy by about 5 minutes to a bulletin board posting. And she hired me and convinced me to ultimately go to graduate school in economics. So it was serendipitous.
Well, I'm glad it worked out. But now, after all your adventures in economics, it's time to fess up.
Oh, boy.
Is this paper stuff we carry around in our wallets really worth anything? And if so, why? And while we're at it, what about all that stuff in my retirement accounts, which isn't even paper, but just pixels on a screen?
Well, that may be two separate questions. I mean, the first thing would be, I guess I'd throw the question back at you, the money in your wallet, can you go do anything with it right now if you wanted to?
Well, I guess I could, yeah. Yeah, because other people are under the impression it's valuable.
Exactly. So if you need to go fill up your car with gas, you can pay in dollars. So we're talking about the United States here. If you want to pay your taxes, you know, the government accepts your payments in dollars. If you want to go buy Google stock, you can go do that in dollars. So it's clearly worth something.
It's worth something just because we kind of like magically endow it with worth. It's not entire. You know, there used to be things like gold that people just valued because I don't know why, but they just valued that. We philosophers call that intrinsic value,
right?
Things that people just value. Money isn't like that. It used to be tied to, I mean, the first money was stuff of intrinsic value,
right?
And then we used to have money that was tied to stuff of intrinsic value, and now we have this money that's just somebody's fiat declares, hey, that's money.
Well, societies and countries have flirted with all different types of monetary systems over time. They're the ones tied to actual intrinsic, you know, metals or things that are of value, and then sometimes there's paper money that's still tied to those things, because originally they actually transacted in gold, right, the actual metal itself. So then I guess I throw back to you, why do we need to have it tied to anything as long as it's serving our needs? In other words, do you need to have a bar of bullion to go buy gas at the gas pump? Why do we need that?
I guess it is tied to something. I mean, in a way, it's like a big system of IOUs.
Mm-hmm.
And an IOU is worth as much as the person who issues it. And it's really not how much they have, because they might have a lot and not give it back to you when you want it. It's how trustworthy they are. So I guess what we're buying is a promise from the United States government, which for some reason I'm not too clear of, we trust.
Let's go back a step, though. I mean, because I read something, I was thinking about learning about money and where it came from, that said money is one of the great inventions in human history.
Yep.
Right. One of the great, more, you know, a greater invention, as great, as consequential as, I don't know, the computer or something.
Yep.
Because this person said barter economies, which were the first economies, just don't work. Why don't they work? And why is money such a great invention?
Well, money is like the oil of a car. At the end of the day, money, some kind of a monetary system would evolve if we didn't have one. And you were mentioning when you all were first talking at the beginning of the show about mediums of exchanges, about stores of value and all those kinds of things. You can quickly imagine a society that didn't have those things and how inefficient it would be. So, for example, let's say I'm a carpenter, right? And let's say that you're a grocer. And I come into your store and I want milk and eggs. Right, and I have to pay you in carpentry services.
Right.
Well, it's like, well, how many hours is that worth? And maybe you don't need that right now.
Right, exactly.
Right? Maybe we need to defer. I mean, you can imagine if you don't have what they call double coincidence of wants.
That's a technical term, right?
Right, which just means you have to want exactly what I have to offer
right.
at that particular point.
And
in time.
Money gets away from that. Right. How? Tell me how money gets away from the double coincidence of wants problem.
Well, it means that if everybody's willing to accept the same thing, then the market then drives, in terms of that actual currency or that money, what different goods and services are worth. So, for example, maybe 10 hours of advising is worth $100 an hour, but 10 hours of carpentry is worth $50 an hour. The market decides that.
Of course, I mean, just to wax philosophical and cynical for a minute, just point out, it's a great thing if we take where we're at as a great place and look back on what made it possible.
Right.
Money made all the huge global economy possible. It made it possible for there to be rich, rich, riches and poor, poor, poors and so forth and so on. And if we think that's all a good thing, money is great. Otherwise, we might have been stuck in self-sufficient small communities that got along just fine.
But John said something really important there, which is all of these other strong economies. Money is a tool. It's not value in and of itself. It's what it backs up and what else the society is doing. So, for example, why you talked about trust and about the government. Why do we believe that the U.S. dollar is worth anything? Well, part of that comes from the, at least one time, strength of the U.S. economy and the goods and services we made.
Right. Now, okay, so but we say money is a store of value, right? Because I can do all this advising, and I can get paid and paid and paid. I can store up my excess value in money.
Right.
And now I can go buy carpentry services and all this sort of stuff, right? And I don't have to make these direct trades.
Right.
That sounds cool. And that sounds like it makes for rational social management or something.
Maybe.
Right? Well, it's the possibility.
Yeah, absolutely. It should work that way.
Right. It's a possibility. But, you know, we said something about the money I pay you back with is worth the same as the money I borrowed from you. But that doesn't happen.
Absolutely not.
And so how does that work?
Well, so for example, let's stop and let's do a hypothetical and say that there's $500 billion worth of currency out there, and somehow I had a counterfeiting machine that was actually able to make dollar bills look exactly like real ones.
Mm-hmm.
Just hypothetically, what do you think that would do to the system if counterfeit money was trading right out there along with real money?
Oh, that would be bad.
Why? Yeah. Why?
I don't know, because there's a lot more money than I thought there was, and so each unit of money is worth less.
A lot more money, which means that the currency's inflated, which means the purchasing power is less than it used to be.
So inflation is a corrosive effect on the standing of money as money in a certain sense.
Exactly.
So why in order to get our economy going and strengthen the dollar, I guess, is the Federal Reserve doing exactly what you described, except since they're the Federal Reserve, it's not counterfeiting, they're printing real money.
Well, John, I don't have a good answer to that because, unfortunately, I don't work at the Federal Reserve, but that's a question every American ought to really be asking understanding.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is money. Our guest is Alex Gould from Stanford University.
In life for free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money. That's what I want. Your love gives me such a thrill, but your love won't pay my bills. I want money.
Money, is that what you really want? This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest today is Alex Gould from the Business School at Stanford University. Look, Alex, it sounds like from our earlier discussion that money now really, and maybe always was, but is really based on trust in governments to act responsibly. But, you know, governments screw up all the time. I mean, they don't always act responsibly. So aren't we skating on thin ice in having this kind of monetary system? Or did we just break through the ice last year, for example?
Well, there's something even deeper on the thin ice that we didn't discuss before that's important to understand this, and that's leverage and debt, right? A lot of people don't understand that what we have in this country, we have what's known as a fractional reserve banking system. And what that basically means is that banks can actually create money at
right,
will.
Right.
So for example, let's say you go and take out a mortgage loan, right? What does the bank have as a claim? Well, they have your home that's collateralizing that loan, and you're promised to pay the loan back. But they're funding your account with that money to buy that house.
Right.
They have created money out of thin air.
Right, and they're allowed to do that. That's credit money, right?
Absolutely, and that's back to the trust, the government that we trust to act responsibly, that's allowing them to do that.
I wondered this at one point, and I guess I know the answer, but it astounded me when I thought about it. So I think of all I think of all the cash in the world. Somehow I think of that as real money.
Yep.
And then I think of all the debt in the world, all the credit in the world, because that's a license to spend, so that's in effect money. So we create all this credit, and I think, okay, if everybody tried to cash in all debts and all, you know, for actual cash, there's a lot more money than there is cash.
So let me try to get concrete. Suppose I have a little bank in Nebraska, let's say, and I have $100,000 in deposits.
Yep.
Right. And now, if I were to buy a printing press and print off some greenbacks, I'd be in big trouble for creating money, and that would be a bad thing. I would be creating inflation.
Yes.
But if instead I take my $100,000 and make $200,000 worth of loans, mm-hmm. which is pretty responsible if they're to good people.
Yes, if they're to good people and businesses.
Yeah, but still, I've created money just the same. Why is it a bad thing if I print it and not a bad thing if I do it in this way?
Well, neither one has to be bad as long as there's something that it's funding that's productive, right? And this is when you have to think about, once again, you have the real economy making goods and services, and then the money that actually serves as the medium of exchange and all those good things that we talked about. So if the money gets out of hand and is out of whack with the goods and services that are getting provided, and we're extending useless, stupid credit, then you can end up with an inflationary situation.
This is what you mean by leverage.
Yes.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about money. How about your money? Do you have enough? Did you lose some of it over the past months? I certainly did. Where did it go? What was it to begin with? And who has the money you lost? David Letterman says Walmart has it all. You got a better answer? Tell us your thoughts.
The number is 415-841-4134. If you put that in terms of commas, you have a small portion of the national debt. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
So leverage. You say it can be a good thing, it can be a bad thing. But it creates more money, right? I mean, what's a measure? I know that there are these four different measures of money supply, M1, M0, M1. I mean,
that's too complicated, yeah, right? Okay. At the end of the day, if there's a certain amount of money out there and people believe that they're eventually going to be paid back and that the economy will ultimately catch up with all the money that's out there, then it's okay. It's like a credit card bill. If I have $10,000 of credit card debt and I keep making my monthly payments but never really reduce the principal, as long as my credit card company believes eventually I'm good for the $10,000 principal, yeah, life goes on.
Right. Well, they like that because you keep paying the interest anyway. And so
exactly. And that, of course, eventually a system isn't sustainable, right? If there's just tons of interest accruing that's greater than the amount of money in the system, eventually this, you know, merry-go-round has to stop, right? The musical chair stops. And Warren Buffett has one of my favorite quotes, which is, when the tide goes down, you can find out who's skinny dipping.
Well, we have an email that extends this metaphor. It's somewhat whimsical. It says, why worry about breaking through the ice when Obama can walk on water? Now, that brings us to the issue. What about Obama's policies? Are you think they're heading the right direction, philosophically speaking?
Philosophically, they scare me a bit, and I wouldn't even set it off based on Obama, say, versus Bush, because they both were involved in bailouts and spending a whole lot of money trying to get us out of this. So I wouldn't necessarily draw it on political lines. I think they're all guilty of the same thing, which is trying to massage the system and throw liquidity at a problem that's much deeper.
I want to go back to the title of that song, you know, the best things in life are free and all that, but can't money. Your love is fine, but your love can't pay the bills. You know, Marx criticized the money economy. You probably know this better than I do, because it turned into commodities.
Mm-hmm.
It threatened to turn into commodity every single thing. The market threatened to swallow up everything and reconfigure the relationships between, as he put it, man and man, right? And he thought that was a bad thing, although it was kind of progress because it was going to lead to communism. But and there are lots of people who think
we're on the route to.
There are lots of people who think that there are some things that money, even if they can buy, shouldn't be able to buy, like your kidneys or something. Or like, if you're my friend and you do me a favor and I say, how about $50 in gratitude? That's odd. You don't buy favors from your friend. What explains why money, some things are, you know, purchasable by money and other things aren't?
Well, in two parts, I would say, does money corrupt people or do people corrupt money? And I actually think it's the latter, right? Money's actually relatively simple, as we defined at the beginning of the show. But when you start to get people involved in it in a capitalistic society, it can get out of hand. And then the ever chase for making more money, I think, can divert us from what is truly the happiness or the utility that you can get in society.
Well, I'm not quite sure I understand you. Do you agree that there are some things, I mean, that money is not the measure of value of all things?
Absolutely.
Right. So what are some things that money is an inappropriate measure of value for? Well, and why? I mean, what explains the limits of money as a measure of value?
I think it's a very personal decision. Each person can choose to do what they want to do with their own money, and it doesn't define happiness, but it can be a tool to leading to whatever they define as being valuable or happy.
Well, I mean, it's what you choose about yourself to commodify. But before I get into that deep thought, we've got an interesting email here.
Okay.
This is from Nicholas Dewar. And he says, everything that Alex Gould is saying is fascinating. That's the good news.
Okay. Uh-oh. But I'm going off a cliff.
But he hasn't really addressed the issues illustrated by anthropologists to open the program. Think of currency as a way to manage the inevitable disequilibrium of any transaction where the double coincidence at once. That's what Alex was talking about, where he says, you know, I've got a donkey and you're a carpenter, and it just turns out that you want a donkey and I need something built. When the double coincident once does not apply, without currency, the traditional way to manage the disequilibrium was interpersonal debt. So we all owed something, or we are owed something by people with whom we had a relationship.
Right.
Every transaction reinforced these relationships. Now by using currency, all those interpersonal debts that provided important glue to our communities is transferred to the Federal Reserve so that this glue is dissolved. What can we do to replace this important glue?
That's a very Marxist question. That's the kind of thing that Marx would worry about, but go ahead.
Well, I mean, to answer that email, you can still have accountability in a system with money, Right. So, for example, in the old world where you would go to your local bank for your car loan or for your mortgage, the banker, part of figuring out, as John put earlier, whether you were loaning to good people was the relationship you'd had over a period of time. But now it wasn't just the Federal Reserve that email said, but these massively large banks and other financial institutions where the person is not as important anymore and the relationship isn't there. If I'm going to foreclose on my home and I got into some teaser mortgage that I couldn't afford and the bank's going to take my home anyway, then I might just be inspired to let the bank take it and not care about the relationship I have with the banker who gave me the loan.
415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. That's how you can join this conversation, or you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. We really want to hear from you. And Felicia in Menlo Park's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Felicia.
Oh, thanks. I think you, the economist gentleman, misspoke, or else my understanding is wrong, or something's changed. He said banks loan money, you know, on houses or whatever, and just they don't even have to have it. They just loan it. I thought there used to be they had to have at least 10% reserve, or and they can borrow from other banks to make that up. Or could you please explain that, or is that law no longer in effect?
No, you're absolutely right. They have to have a certain percentage of reserve, and there's capital requirements on what the bank has to have on reserve on what they can loan against, but they do create money. In other words, at any point in time, if there's a run on the bank, the reason that banks worry about that is that they're not going to have all the cash there to be able to pay you. If they were just lending what they had, then they would always have enough to be able to cover that.
Why is it a good thing? Thanks for the question, Felicia. Why is it a good thing, or is it a good thing, that banks can borrow, lend more money than they actually have in reserve? I mean, because if everybody panicked, it'd be the depression, why is that a good thing?
Well, there's a good explanation and a nefarious one. The good one is that there's lots of creditworthy people and businesses out there, people trying to build equity in their homes, businesses trying to build productive services for our economy, that if you extend them credit, they might not be able to function and produce for the economy otherwise. But if you're just extending credit, and this is where the evil and the corruption happens, if the intermediaries like the banks just want to make a ton of money on fees and on lending, and the beast must eat, so to speak, then we get disaligned with the real value.
So help me understand this current credit crisis, because the banks aren't lending, even though the government's trying to do all this stuff to incentivize lending and putting all this money into this bank, and then they're not lending. Well, what's up with that?
Well, the problem is that if you think about a balance sheet, right, a bank like any other business has assets, and then people have claims to those assets. And the problem is that many of the loans, which are assets to the banks, like mortgages and other things, right, there have been defaults, right? And so the bank's assets have started to get wiped out. And so you have illiquid assets that they don't have values on. And then the problem is that if they don't have a value and they're technically insolvent, right, they can't function normally because they have this albatross on their balance sheet.
So let me just see if I've got something kind of straight about the current crisis.
Yep.
Now banks have to have a reserve, let's say 10%.
Right.
So that is, if they're going to lend out $100,000, they have to have $10,000.
Sure.
To do it. Now insurance companies also have to have a reserve.
Yeah.
That is, if I'm going to insure 1,000 people, write fire insurance for their homes.
Yep.
Then I have to have enough cash in the bank to actually pay some of them,
yep,
but maybe not 10%, maybe just 1%.
Okay.
So is that right? Insurance companies typically have much less a reserve compared to the risk, or compared to the total amount of money they're dealing with in banks, because the risk for each one is less or something like that?
Well, number one, insurance companies are regulated, right? The insurance industry is regulated. And we're going to talk about synthetic insurance and how you can provide insurance without that. But to answer your question, insurance companies are regulated. But as far as those reserves go, actuaries that run insurance companies are actually looking empirically at the likelihood that bad things are going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And to be a solvent business, they want to keep enough on reserve so that the probability of a crisis should it happen, that they don't get wiped out.
415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. Shan in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Shan.
Thank you so much. I'm going to get very philosophical with you. I am the itinerant poet that calls on occasion.
Oh.
A very recent haiku came to me, but I get inspiration from things as far out as fortune cookie fortunes. My favorite is, wealth is a state of mind. Now, here's the haiku. Fortune is fickle. She'll leave you in a pickle. But don't they taste good?
Thanks for that haiku, Shan. Look, that leads me to a question that okay, I've lost a lot of wealth, as whole lots of people have. I put that in terms of I've lost a lot of money. Is there a difference between wealth and money? If the total wealth goes down of the United States, has money disappeared? I mean, what's the relationship between money and wealth?
Well, so here we come back to store of value, right? In other words, you could actually hold money in your mattress. And right, if you have cash in your mattress, that's technically, if that's all you have, that's your wealth. But you might own stocks, you might own bonds, you might own a lot of other things that are also wealth. And so wealth can be other things beside money.
So when my wealth disappears, no money has to have disappeared.
Well, what is money? Money comes back to liquidity. If you want to go buy things, people are going to want money, right? It's going to be hard for you to take Google stock certificate.
Well, certainly, I have less money. But is there less money around? And did somebody get my money when I lost it?
Walmart.
Or did money just disappear? did money just evaporate and it doesn't exist anymore?
Well, that's what the system's digesting now, is a whole lot of money that on paper, right, these various wealth, these sorts of toxic assets we were discussing, no one knows what they're worth, and they have to be digested by the system. So yes, it can disappear.
So I want to get back to these toxic assets. I thought there was, as I understand it, there's somehow the people like AIG managed to fiddle the system so that banks pretended to be insurance companies.
Yes.
And
that's exactly right.
With much lower reserves, and that's the problem. Can you explain that a little?
Well, one of the problems you have is that regulators, right, can almost never keep up with the innovation in a financial market. So for example, in the old world, if you wanted insurance, you went to an insurance company. Right, but say that I, as a banker, found that there was a market in my being able to insure your risk. Mm-hmm. So John comes to me and says, Alex, you know something? I've got all these loans on my portfolio, and I'm worried they could default. I'm willing to pay you X amount per year to make sure that should they default, my institution won't be insolvent, right?
So that's credit default insurance.
Essentially, yeah. Right? It's a little more complicated, but that's basically what it is. Now, what that depends on is, am I good to ultimately pay out should your loans default, right? And AIG was a major counterparty on a lot of these things where they provided insurance for exactly those types of defaults. And we talked about Buffett and the tide going out and being caught skinny dipping. If things are good, you can hold up a whole lot of leverage with a house of cards and no one really asks any questions. But if people start to get nervous, it's like a run on a bank, right? They start calling in collateral on loans. They start calling in credit. Everyone gets nervous. The house of cards with all the leverage falls down.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing money with Alex Gould from Stanford University.
What's your attitude towards money in the current crisis? Are you buying Krugerrands or Canadian maple leaf coins? Are you stuffing 20s in your mattress? Are you investing in diamonds or oil? Of course, there's no better investment than local public broadcasting.
We'll take more of your calls and emails in a moment, but first, let's hear from the folks at KALW about how you can invest in local media and help keep programs like Philosophy Talk on the air.
Money.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound, a mark, a yen, a buck or a pound is all that makes the world go around. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money. If you happen to be rich and you feel like a night's entertainment, you can pay for a gay escapade. If you happen to be rich and alone and you need a companion, you can ring ting-a-ling for the mate. If you happen to be rich and you find you are left by your lover and you moan and you groan quite a lot, you can take it on the chin, call a cab and begin to recover on your 14-carat yacht. What? Money makes the world go round, the world go round.
I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing money with Alex Gould from Stanford University. Alex, you agreed that money was one of the great inventions in human history because it makes it possible this rational coordination of human activity, right? And you've got this complicated money system in with credit money and all that. And you said that's a good thing. It can be a very good thing because it spurs productive activity.
Right.
And that's a great thing. But you know, and you got this government backing all this money, but once this system is in place, it seems to me there's a big doubt. No, there are no unmixed blessings. And once this system is in place, once credit is available, I can get credit to get to buy things that I shouldn't be buying. I can do this crazy thing, these Ponzi schemes like the banks turning into insurers, you know, and insuring crazy risk. And then the whole thing can come collapsing.
And
so it's,
Ken, then the reverse side of that is that when things get really bad, then good people can't get credit and good businesses
right.
can't get credit because we overreact the other way.
So it's got its... I mean, I'm trying to figure out if the upsides and the downsides sort of balance out, or if it's really bad, unbalanced, because it makes all this crazy activity possible. I mean, look at the U.S. economy. It's in a crazy situation.
Well, it is in a crazy situation, but there's no question that a developed society needs some kind of a monetary system, right? I think the question is whether our fractional reserve system, our system with all of this leverage, and the current financial regulations the way they are inspire the best in agents in the economy, so to speak.
So let me return to this great metaphor by Warren Buffett.
Yep.
That when the tide goes out, you see who's skinny dipping.
Yep.
So we saw who was skinny dipping. The AIG was skinny dipping. Maybe that explains the bonuses. So we're giving the bonuses to the ones who look really cute, skinny dipping.
Right.
But at any rate, leaving that aside, another skinny dipper was Madoff, mm-hmm. right? I mean, he had this system where it was a Ponzi scheme, but
yep.
it could have kept going.
Yes.
I mean, as long as people are buying into it in sufficient quantities to pay the people that want to redeem, he was fine. Could have kept going till he died.
Right.
Now, how about the U.S. government?
Yep.
I mean, a cynic might say it's a Ponzi scheme, right? As long as the Chinese and Americans and keep buying our bonds, we keep going. If they stop, is there any real difference between us and Madoff?
No, there isn't, right?
Oh.
And that's what I
man, that's a depressing answer.
Right, well, that's not what we want to hear. And we were talking a little bit, you know, off mic a little earlier about generational gaps and the fact that especially, you know, younger folks haven't really been through a time of pain and haven't had to really ask these types of tough questions. You know, the U.S. government is not infallible, and neither is our society. And if we are not continuing to create value and we continue to rack up leverage, exactly those questions are the case.
So, right. So, you know, there's this whole monetary exchange, the euro, the yen, all this stuff.
Yep.
And I guess the Chinese want it and the Russians would like to see the U.S. dollar not be the reserve currency for the world.
Right.
But, you know, what... I take it that part of the vibrancy of the U.S. dollar has to do with the vibrancy of the U.S. economy.
Absolutely.
Right. And the trust that the U.S. government, whatever's going to happen, is not going to default on its obligations because we've got this vibrant economy that creates all this wealth and good and all that stuff. Right.
Well, it used to be considered that, you know, currency and U.S. government T-bills and all of those things, like you say, were considered infallible. It was the reserve currency and the U.S. was the strongest economic power in the world. But there's indication in the markets that people aren't believing that anymore, especially with what the Federal Reserve Bank has been doing recently. And this plays into John calling it a Ponzi scheme. Right. With the amount of credit that the Fed is extending to troubled institutions right now, and with that spurt in the money supply, right, many people argue, and I would agree, that eventually it has to be inflationary, which then reduces purchase power, which then brings in the question of, can the U.S. currency remain the reserve currency, and then what's our state in the world?
Right, right. We've got a caller with a question on just this topic, I think. Reed in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Reed.
Hi. My question is with regard to credit cards. Most credit card companies offer programs where you essentially buy insurance in the event that you lose your source of income so that the card will be paid off. And I'm wondering if this is comparable to a credit default swap. In other words, there might be so many obligations out there to pay off cards that if the bottom falls out, there wouldn't be enough money to pay them off.
That's exactly what it is. In other words, if you look at, you know, the AIG example or any other one of your favorite banks or hedge funds that are all in bed with each other, taking different sides of different swaps and different insurance arrangements, and again, we have this sort of house of cards with a ton of leverage supporting the entire thing. All it takes is for a couple of large banks to get nervous and start calling in loans, at which point it's like a run on a bank and people, you know, you're caught with your pants down.
So, see, you know, Reed, thanks for the call. This reminds me of this is kind of a philosophical question, but this is a philosophy show. So when you start thinking about the invention of money as a great thing, you talk about the rational management of diverse wants, right? I've got all this stuff. I want something else. I want to trade you. Money is a storehouse of value.
Right.
You think of the modern monetary system, though, it's a partly about that, but it's also about this strange risk management thing. There are all these credit is a risk-taking thing.
Yep.
Lending is a risk-taking thing. And now the whole monetary system is based on the kind of rational management of risk, and I'm not so sure that human beings are so good at rationally managing risk. I mean, you look at all this behavioral economics, we're actually pretty bad at it.
And this is why some institutions are regulated in a different way from others. The banking system and insurance companies and so forth have always had certain positions in society where they perform functions that need to be there. And so they're regulated differently from, say, an investment bank or from a hedge fund or whatever, because the commodity they're playing with is so important to the functioning of society.
So I want to read another whimsical email, and then I have a question for you, Alex. Richard Moe says, if you put your money in your mattress, use an air mattress. That way you can control inflation. Now, here's my question. Let's suppose we make you czar of America or America and Europe.
Yep.
And we say, look, Alex, we didn't elect you. We're not going to reelect you. Nobody's going to blame you or credit you. You're going to be anonymous. But you just take control of the economy and keep in mind not what's going to happen in a year or two, but keep in mind the health of the world economy, the United States economy, 25, 50 years from now.
Yep.
What would you do?
Two things. And we're talking just about America right now, the United States?
As whatever you want to talk about. But let's start with the U.S.
Well, first, I'd embark on a massive education system for the public to understand exactly what's happened. I think it's important that everybody understand, because I would need their buy-in to what I was about to say next. Mm-hmm. I would say that our collective U.S. body is undergoing massive indigestion, and that if we don't want our society to collapse, we all have to understand what's going on and the pain that it's going to take to actually fix it. And I think the first part of fixing that pain is devising the system. And the government's trying to do this right now where we digest these bad assets. And I think what it basically says is, look, banking's a good business. As we've already agreed, loans need to happen, credit needs to be extended, but it needs to be done manageably. And there needs to be a payment plan, right? Where you, like paying off a credit card, where you pay down the value of these assets over time so that wealth doesn't evaporate,
right?
So that it's just paid down in a way that we can all afford. At the same time, we need to be looking very hard at how we can continue to compete as a country.
Well, see, this is the thing I worry about. This is not a philosophical question, but it's in my advancing age, I have dark thoughts. I actually can't think of any reason anymore, objectively, why Americans should be the most prosperous people in the world going forward in the 21st century. I mean, I look at our habits, our spending habits, our productivity. I mean, we are very good at certain things, but there are many, many, many things we're not that good at anymore. We don't educate our kids better than the rest of the world. You know, I mean, so why should Americans have the most money in the world going forward in the 21st century?
I think we're an entrepreneurial country. I think we're basically positive, optimistic people who try to look for the best, especially in bad times. And I mean, even in the place where we live right here in Silicon Valley, constant innovation going
on.
There's always someone trying to come up with a business plan. In fact, if you don't have a business plan in your pocket, it's like the Hollywood script that you don't have.
That's true. So we've got, I think we have an entrepreneurial vanguard.
Yes.
An elite entrepreneurial vanguard. But you look at our savings rate and all this other stuff, our education, how much money we spend per capita. I mean, the rest of the world is like starting to kick our butt. And I just don't know that an entrepreneurial vanguard will be enough going forward.
Well, I think we may be moving toward a world in which our power is somewhat decreased, but we can partner with these countries instead of letting them just completely kick our butts, right? We partner with them, provide our entrepreneurial vanguard in conjunction with some of their resources and their ideas, right, so that we can continue to survive. But the days may be gone where we dictate, where our currency is the reserve currency and where we dictate the political and economic future of the world. It might be that it's more like a G20 that sits together and kind of decides how to divide the pie, and we have a place at that table, but we're not the chair.
Well, ultimately, it seems like the Chinese idea may not be the time for it, but why shouldn't it be the economy of the whole world that backs our money rather than the economy of the United States?
Well, that may be where it's going.
Well, on that note, Alex, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been an enriching conversation.
It was a blast. Thanks for having me.
Our guest has been Alex Gold from the Stanford University School of Business. This conversation continues, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blago, I think, therefore I blog, and also join up on our Facebook community.
Philosophy Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2009.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Our directors of research are Daniel Elstein and Cole Leahy. Lael Weiss is our webmaster.
Also thanks to Zoe Corneli, Merle Kessler, Corey Goldman, Jennifer Jensen, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Templeton Foundation. Also from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking. Thank you.